David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 148 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You'll be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photograph. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. See theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.php for more information. If you want to make monthly donations, please go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others of your ideas. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered on my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you listening, commenting, suggesting guests, and your financial support as well. Feedback this week from Alex. First of all, congratulations on your amazing work with the Infectious Myth Radio Show and for your great commitment to exposing the truth. Ever since I found by chance online your interview with Peter Duisberg, I'm in awe of your knowledge. It's easy for me to become a follower and supporter of your work, as I tend to distrust pretty much everything that comes from the big establishments, especially in medicine. In particular, I'd like to better understand whether there's any authenticity at all to the HIV test, since it's still recommended depending on the sexual lifestyle of an individual. I responded, "Thanks for writing and thanks for the kind words about my show. I think the best way to approach the validity of any HIV test is to think about how to validate an HIV test, or any other viral test for that matter. It fits nicely into Koch's postulates that are really designed to prove that pathogen A, e.g. HIV, is the cause of disease B, e.g. AIDS, even though it's not really a disease but a syndrome. Koch's postulates are approximately the following. First, purify the pathogen, HIV in this case, inject it into a susceptible animal. Obviously, you can't really do this experiment on humans. Verify that the disease, in this case AIDS, a syndrome, is caused. And lastly, repurify pathogen A. This has never been accomplished. In fact, the first step of purifying HIV has never been accomplished. This not only means that we have never proven that HIV causes AIDS, but it also means that we've never validated any type of test. You cannot know that a test detects HIV antibodies, for example, unless you've injected the pure virus into an animal and verify that the antibodies only appear after that, and that the antibodies are not found in animals that have not been exposed to the virus. By the time you hear this episode, I will have given a presentation on the criminalization of HIV, which discusses the issue of the existence of HIV and the validation of HIV tests. And I will go through what's in my presentation at some point in the future, so I will go through this in more detail. But now, let's get to this week's interview. David Smith is a genital autonomy activist. He's chief officer of Genital Autonomy, a charity in the UK which tries to protect female, male, and intersex children from genital mutilation, and also the chief officer of another charity, 15 Square, that specifically focuses on male circumcision. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Hello.
Yeah, well, thanks for staying up late so that we can talk about...
No problem.
Genital autonomy. So let's first start talking about male circumcision. We'll also address female genital mutilation and intersex interference close to birth.
Yes, unnecessary intersex surgery.
Right. So how did you get interested in these issues? I presume male circumcision was your first interest, or maybe I'm wrong on
it
that.
It was indeed. Yeah, yes. I got interested in 1994. There were a doctor, John Warren, wrote a letter in The Independent. He'd been over to America to meet some of the activists there, and he wrote a letter in the Independent to say that he thought that there was a need for an organisation in the UK that helped men who'd been damaged by circumcision, and if anybody was interested, would they contact him? I contacted him, and 19 of us met in a flat in London in, I think it was October or November 1994, and it was from there that we formed an organisation, originally called Norm UK. But we very quickly went on, I mean, we were obviously, this was intended to help men who'd been circumcised, but very quickly we were contacted by intact men who'd got a problem with their foreskin, and they wanted to keep their foreskin, so we became sort of multifunctional, really.
Okay, well, that's kind of interesting. So you're talking, I mean, we normally think of circumcision as something that's done shortly after birth, but you're talking about men who presumably have some kind of a problem, and a doctor maybe is recommending circumcision. And what kind of problems are there that a man might have that would result in a doctor saying you need to be circumcised?
Well, circumcision really fell out of favour in the UK in the 1940s. So from the 1940s onwards, it's got less and less common. What usually happens is that it although it's not done routinely it's normally the first course of treatment for any disorder of the foreskin. So if a man has phimosis, for instance, a doctor will usually recommend a circumcision because it's the only treatment they know.
Oh, can you define phimosis? Because I doubt that most people know what that is.
Okay, phimosis is a tight foreskin.
Oh, okay.
Basically, some men have a foreskin that won't retract. Some won't retract at all, and others will retract partially, normally when they're flaccid, but not when they're hard.
Right.
So it's what was amazing, really, with the advent of the internet. Now, a lot of people with any sort of illness or problem, if they go to a doctor and the doctor tells them the solution, and they research it, and we get a lot of people, we get a lot of men now who say, well, my doctor's told me I need a circumcision, I really don't want one, and I hear there are alternatives. So really it's down to education of the medical profession that alternatives are available, that men don't want to lose their foreskins.
And what kind of alternatives?
You should be treating them conservative. Stretching, there are several ways of preserving a foreskin. First of all, if it's only a slight phimosis, if it's only slightly tight, then it's fairly easy to stretch it yourself to make it mobile. And there are devices that do help. There's one called the Dlanzi, but there are others that actually do stretch the foreskin. We're trying with manufacturers to develop some more because it is a growing market. As more and more, there are more and more intact men with this problem, there's obviously a market for that product.
What kind of numbers are we talking about in England of men who have this problem?
I would say not too many, really. Nobody really knows the true extent of circumcision because very often it's not recorded. But I would say certainly only about 5 or 6%, something like that, I would estimate. That actually go on to or have circumcisions in this country, and most of it is done for religious reasons.
Right.
There are not too many. There are far more than there should be, but there are still not too many done for phimosis. It's
right.
Luckily
now,
getting rarer.
The natural development of the foreskin is that it's, my understanding, and you're more of an expert, obviously, but is that it's tight when you're young, but when you reach puberty, that it generally loosens up and starts to become retractable.
Yes. In 1949, there was a doctor, a Gairdner, and Gairdner did a study, and he said that the foreskin is not unusual for it not to retract until the age of three. So this was in 1949. So the medical profession took that study to say if it isn't retractable by three, then you should circumcise, but that's not strictly true. And there was I think in the 1960s, somewhere about 1968, there was a Danish guy by the name of Erster, and they did another study, And they said that the foreskin sometimes is not retractable until puberty. It can be even 18 or 19. Well, and that's certainly borne out by a lot of the inquiries we get, that quite often the other thing that happens is that because it's the function of the foreskin is not taught in sex education, quite often they, and parents are too embarrassed to tell children, quite often teenagers don't really know that their foreskin's supposed to retract.
Mm.
Which is in the 21st century, it's really we're a bit puritanical. I mean, in the Nordic countries, in Denmark, and certainly in Finland, it's. I mean, I think the circumcision rate in Finland is less than 0.1%.
Mm.
So they teach children, and you know, there's very little. There's very little need for circumcisions in those countries, and there should be here.
I'm pretty sure I remember my foreskin retracting for the first time when I was about 11. I mean, maybe for some people this is too much information, but I think that goes to say I have a pretty clear memory of being quite surprised when it went back for the first time. And, of course, I had never even thought about it. I just thought it was going to be the way it was forever, but I didn't know anything about puberty either. You know, growing up in England and Canada, I don't think the level of sex education I got was that wonderful back in the...
I don't think it is now. we are working with a wonderful organization in Finland called Sexpo, S-E-X-P-O.
Right.
And the Sexpo Foundation have designed a series of comics for specially designed for teenagers. And they answer questions that teenagers really want to ask about, that they're not covered in sex education, so they're about relationships and all sorts of things. And they are intending to work with us on a series of comics designed to really answer the questions on the foreskin and the function and circumcision. So the Finns are very much ahead of us in that respect.
Right. I kind of get the feeling from what little I know about sex education that it's more oriented towards what we want to tell children as opposed to what children want to know. And, of course,
that's not a good way
to teach.
Whereas the Finns are very, you know, very, and the Danes are certainly far more open. They have a very much... more relaxed attitude. I think in the UK we have a far more relaxed attitude than in the... I mean, having been to the US several times...
the US is a strange mixture of sexual puritanism and sexual liberation, and somehow they coexist in the same country. If you go to a grocery store in the United States, they have... you know, magazines with the sex life of movie stars and lots of cleavage and people in skimpy bikinis and all this kind of stuff. And on the other hand, they have groups that are, you know, have that encouraging children to remain celibate until marriage, the promise rings, all these kinds of things, and teaching abstinence, all this kind of stuff. So you get two diametrically opposed trends in the same country, which is interesting.
The other problem with that we have here is obviously some of the research that's carried out in America that's really shouldn't be promoted anyway. You know, circumcision is a very cultural thing there. And obviously some of it occasionally makes its way into the British press. So we quite often have a reporter ringing, and there's all sorts of things. I remember being on a radio interview, I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago, and a study came out from America that said circumcision helps to prevent prostate cancer. And I was interviewed by a BBC local radio station. They also interviewed a urologist locally and said, "What do you think?" And she said, I can't remember the exact word she said, but she said it's complete and utter rubbish. But, you know, these things do get reported and people...
Well, it's funny how a correlation, which if they don't like it, is you're always reminded that correlation doesn't equal causation. But if they like it, then you pretty much jump to policy changes without stopping to consider whether there's something causing the correlation that's not causative. Oh, well, is there still promotion of circumcision in the UK outside of religious or cultural
No, groups? Not at all. And we've had some interesting court cases in the last 2 or 3 years that, well, I've been personally involved in. There was one, I think it was, time goes so quickly, I think it was last year or the year before, and it was a groundbreaking court case, really, and it was two boys. It was the problem that happens here, that there's two problems. Well, I think the problem that usually occurs is where there is a demand for a religious circumcision, and hospitals do not perform them. So the problem they have here is they're asked to do a religious circumcision. They will not do it. So quite often, somebody does it in their home, and then the children are rushed to hospital to be patched up. It is a problem. It's not available on the NHS for non-medical reasons at all. So anybody wanting it would have to pay for it. There is now an issue with consent, and just to get back to that case I was telling you about, it was a mixed marriage where mother was white British, father was, I think, Algerian, I can't remember. And they agreed when they had their, if they had boys, that they, you know, the father said, well, in view of my culture, I would want them circumcised. And the mother said she had no objection. They had two children, two boys, and the father would not have it done straight away because he wanted it done in a ceremony, I think, back in his home country.
Right.
They then separated, and when the boys were 4 and 6, the father said, I want it done now. And the mother said, no.
She changed her mind.
She changed her mind, and she said the boys are too old for this. So it went to court, and it was a leading case where, and the case was, the verdict of the case was that the judge said that those children were to be protected until they were old enough to make up their own mind at 16 or 18. So now I think the deciding factor on that was the fact that the children were being brought up in a country area in the UK where although they saw their father occasionally, they were not being brought up in a purely Islamic household. So
you think it might have been a different, like if they were being brought up by the father in an Islamic household or switched the gender, brought by the mother, that might have been a different outcome.
Well, yes, I'm not actually sure, but I mean, this is obviously, there are more cases coming to court now.
Right.
That was the second one I was aware of, and the first one happened in the 1990s when I was first involved, and that went exactly the same way.
Okay.
There is a case that is happening at the moment. Actually, it's going on as we speak. It hasn't come to court yet. But this is the exact opposite scenario, where same thing. It was a mixed. Mother was white British. Father was a Muslim, and the relationship broke up. The boy is now 4. The relationship broke up more or less immediately. Mother said she'd no objection to the parents. To the father having custody of, the child occasionally, the boy occasionally. And when he was 3 months old, father took him to his parents to celebrate Eid. And when he was returned to the mother and she went to change his nappy, he'd been circumcised.
Without any conversation, just did it.
Yep. So she's taken 4 years to try and get somebody to take some this seriously, and it's now going through the courts in the UK. They last month they arrested the doctor and the grandparents. I think that they're out on bail now. So this this will go to court.
Right, right.
So the result of this case obviously will have a great influence. So basically, I think at the moment, if both parents agree, then up to now there isn't an issue. But the issue is where one parent says no and the other parent says yes. The court will go on the side of the
children, really.
The child.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To me, it seems like a no-brainer, as we like to say over in North America, that it can still be done when a child's 16 or 18,
yeah.
And the child
yeah.
at that point has. I mean, it's kind of like tattooing. People probably put tattoos on their genital areas. People put piercings in all kinds of sensitive yeah. areas in their body. And if you're 16 or 18, if you want to do something that you might regret later, that's your choice. You're an adult. You get the right to do decisions that you might regret later.
But I mean, if you tattooed a child or you pierced a child, then on the penis, then a boy rather, then obviously you would be in prison, but cut off his foreskin and you know,
yes,
cruel, basically.
I mean, is there anything that can be done to retrieve or redevelop the foreskin?
Yes, there are there are ways of restoring it, and not surgically. The foreskin is very unique tissue. It's got a lot of nerve endings, and it's a specialist tissue, so that it is not possible to restore a foreskin surgically. But
there's nothing like it on your body. There's nothing else like it.
Yeah, your eyelids. Your eyelids.
Oh, your eyelids. But who wants to lose their eyelids, right?
Well, quite.
Yes.
Yeah. And obviously there wouldn't be the same amount of tissue, because the foreskin, the average amount lost to a male is 15 square inches. Which is hence the term 15 square.
I was going to ask you about the reason for the name of your charity, 15 square.
Yeah.
That's quite a lot. If I do the math, that's 100 square centimeters?
In old measurements, it's roughly 5 inches by 3 inches.
It's
the equivalent of a British banknote, a British £10 note.
Okay, that's a good way to think about it.
If you fold a £10 note in half and then wrap it round, doesn't look much, but when you unfold it and you see the amount of tissue lost, it's quite substantial.
Yeah, that is a bit, because it is very, very flexible tissue, right? It can stretch quite a bit.
Mm. But so to get back to restoration, the way to do to restoring it is to stretch it. And there are, in the early days when I first started, there were some very cumbersome devices invented, and there were certainly things that you could still make your own device, as long as you've got a device that puts the skin under gentle tension.
Mm-hmm.
And after putting gentle tension for for a prolonged period, the skin does stretch gradually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there are specialist devices. Most of them are made in America. I think that the TLC Tugger is probably the most common device from America. And that has a great success rate. One of our advisors, we have a doctor on our board, and he was circumcised at birth, and he's fully restored his foreskin and even fooled one of his colleagues into thinking he was intact.
Hmm. Okay. So that's good, but that's still not. I mean, that's a lot of hassle to go through to return to a state that you could be in if your parents.
No, you don't get the full amount of nerve endings back.
Okay.
The nerve endings are gone for good.
So it's not the same.
It's not the same. You get a certain amount of sensation back.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
The glands of the penis is not meant to be an external organ. It's meant to be covered.
Right. And
so when you lose the covering, it thickens up, and that's when you lose some sort of sensation.
Right.
There's a lot of the main problem is that the function of the foreskin has never really been researched much, and it's something that I've been interested in. One of our colleagues, we have a Danish colleague, and he did some research to say that the circumcision affects orgasm in males. Mm-hmm. And from what I have gleaned, because obviously over the last 20 years I've had, well, I've got sufficient inquiries to fill 26 lever arch files from men who've been circumcised and have problems with it.
Right.
And one of the theories that this man came up with, he's done research on it. He said he thought that circumcision affects the orgasm, affects the man's ability to have orgasm. And I said to him that, what do you mean by an orgasm? Is what you determine an orgasm the sensation you get when you ejaculate? And he said, no, you can have an orgasm without an ejaculation. And I personally think a lot of circumcised men have a sensation on ejaculation that they think is an orgasm, but I don't think they ever have orgasms.
Which is a terrible thing. Yes, it's very hard. It's like saying, do you see red the same way I see red? Like, how would we...
Yes.
Know, right?
Yeah. It's like if you're born colorblind, how do you know what real color is?
Yes.
And it's only when... And it's quite interesting, because I asked one or two intact men, you know, what do you have a sensation that you would describe as an orgasm? And is that a different sensation to the sensation you get when you ejaculate? And they said very firmly, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of circumcised men have said, oh, no, I get a sensation. I have an orgasm when I ejaculate, and I don't have another
right.
sensation.
Right.
But how you prove that, I don't know. And another interesting thing that I have come across, and there again, how do you investigate it, is I was giving a talk at a sexual dysfunction clinic
mm-hmm.
in the UK. And one of the specialists said that some circumcised men have premature ejaculation, and some men have difficulty climaxing at all.
Mm-hmm.
They can't, you know, with. And how would you explain that? And another man in the audience, another specialist in the audience, thought about it for a while, and he said, when you are circumcising a penis, you are cutting around the entire circumference of the penis. You're separating the skin, cutting a chunk out, and then rejoining it. And it's like rewiring an appliance.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, what you are doing, you are joining nerve endings to nerve endings.
Right.
And where it joins up will depend on the future function. So if you get the nerve endings lined up as they you can never line them up because you cut a chunk out.
Right.
But to me, that makes perfect sense. But how do you study it?
Yeah, that seems like something that's very difficult to study, and it's not amenable to a clinical trial, which would probably be highly unethical. Anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, what are some of the major issues that men who have been circumcised deal with that they believe are due to the circumcision?
Well, first of all, it's the look of it, because they are very much in the minority and they're very often ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that happens is when they have when they have sexual encounters, especially if their partner has had a previous intact partner, they know the difference, and quite often they will struggle. It's not the same as
so you're saying that the foreskin has a function for the woman as well?
Yes, yeah. It's quite often a lot of they have problem with lubrication, for instance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Circumcised men will have to use artificial lubricants where a normal man doesn't.
Oh,
you know,
I see. So it's the contact at the foreskin on the woman that causes the lubrication.
Friction.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is different than the friction with a hardened glands that doesn't have a foreskin. Okay, well, that is something I'd never really thought about whether it makes a difference for the woman, but you did talk about some cases where there's been divorces based on circumcision. I mean, was that due to that reason, that sex was difficult? Yeah. Or yes?
Yeah, we've got one or two examples on our files where this has actually happened. The woman has said, you know, I can't cope with this.
Mm.
And it does cause problems. So, you know, I mean, a lot of men are quite happy with the circumcision. And like we just said, if you've been born colorblind, you don't know what real sight is, you know, you've got nothing to compare it to.
Yeah, and I mean, if you value your religion above, you know, how you value your foreskin, I guess that's fine if you're making that decision as an adult. There have been cases where children have died or been seriously injured during
yes.
circumcision. And what was the cause of that? The blood loss or the anesthetic or other things?
Usually septicemia, usually infection, or as you say, blood loss. But usually, and sometimes it can be heart failure, especially if a child's being operated on without anesthesia when
okay.
they are very young. It can very often, it'll affect the heart.
Right.
So there was something else I was going to mention about, you were talking about the function. I'll think about that and go back to it because you reminded me of something else and
okay.
I've now forgotten what it was.
Okay, well, if you think of it, we'll come back to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Has there been any talk about interfering with the religious rites? I believe it's the Jewish faith and the Muslim faith to a lesser extent that believe that circumcision
yes.
is a religious requirement.
Yes, I believe in Judaism it's a mitzvah, it's a command. You have to do it on the eighth day.
Right.
In Islam, it's a recommendation. I don't think that there's anything that says it has to be done. It's a recommendation.
Right.
And there's no ceremony in Islam. So in Judaism, it's usually done by they have trained moils who do the procedure.
Right.
But in Islam, there's no ceremony. It's just done. So it's either done, it can be done any time up to the teenagers, basically.
You, on your website, you mentioned that there are alternative ceremonies and also more resistance within the Jewish community to this procedure.
There's Brit Shalom is a ceremony that they have the ceremony but without the knife.
Okay.
This is surprising. I've over the years I've been contacted by a surprising amount of Jewish families who just don't do it. You know, it's like Catholics and birth control.
I was just talking about that, about how, I don't know if it was my mother who observed that, you know, although still today Catholics have a prohibition on birth control, the birth rate amongst Catholics went down pretty much the same as in other groups.
Yeah.
Once North America in the 60s, I guess, had pretty much widespread access to birth control.
Yes, yes. But Brit Shalom is especially in America, it's very heavily promoted.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a Brit Shalom celebrant in the UK. Lovely guy, I know him quite well. And but there are also a lot of organizations. There's Jews Against Circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
That's run by Ron Goldman. That's based in the US. There's even one in Israel. There's an organization, I think it's called Kahal, K-A-H-A-L, and that's an organization for parents who've left their children intact.
Okay, okay. So I guess it's support is diminishing. I presume there's still, I mean, is it defended mostly on a religious basis, or are people saying not only is it religious, but there's other benefits too, such as prevention of disease and things like that?
Not here. I think in the UK it's just regarded as a religious thing, or if The usual thing, if somebody's been circumcised in the UK, the general feeling is that it's either been done for a religious reason or you've had a problem.
Right.
Nobody would think you'd do it routinely. It just doesn't happen here.
Right. When you were talking about people doing circumcisions at home because it's not an NHS procedure, and it's not just that it's not funded by the NHS, but you can't go to an NHS doctor and have it done, right? Like you have to...
No, you have to pay for it.
You have to pay for it. I mean, could a doctor, could a GP do circumcisions if they felt like and get paid for it directly by the patient?
Yes. You can still do it. You could still do it and charge for it. So it's not, although it's not available on the NHS, a doctor could do it privately if asked and if he wanted to. A lot of doctors won't.
Right, right.
But some will. But there was an interesting. I think we were getting. I know what I was going to say to you earlier. It's just come back into my mind. The problem is we were talking about consent, and I think the consent issue has never been explored. I think it's just been carried on in this country without really questioning. You know, it's fallen out of fashion. It's not done routinely by the NHS, and it's just done by default. And it was interesting that you mentioned intersex, because a colleague of mine, I was at the World Association of Sexual Health Conference in Prague. I was giving a talk in May.
Right.
And one of my colleagues who was with me was saying that the consent issue has never really been explored. So certainly in the UK, it's illegal you cannot even put a ritual nick on a girl. It's even though there's never been a successful prosecution in the UK, there is a law against it. So you cannot touch the genitals of a girl at all. But with boys, you know, as you were saying, you can't tattoo or pierce it, but it's generally been, it's never been, the legality of it has never been questioned. Undoubtedly,
right.
It is illegal because you're cutting, it, for a non-therapeutic reason, you are cutting through a false thickness of skin, so that's a wounding against the Persons Act, so you could use an existing law.
Well, that's actually interesting, because I interviewed... more of an academic who was quite well educated on the whole circumcision thing, and he was noting that in some cases of circumcision of females or female genital mutilation, it's actually less damage than a male circumcision, because a male circumcision tends to be more of a it's sort of the same, similar with all men, whereas for women it varies from like a ritual nick to full removal of the clitoris. Right.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And
the lesser part of female is more damaging than the lesser part is less damaging than a male circumcision, which removes a lot of tissue.
Right. So that was kind of interesting, because and he was very careful to say, just like, I believe all female genital mutilation is wrong, even if it's a mark that has no impact on your sexual function or other problems throughout your life. It's a choice that a girl should make when she's mature enough to make that choice.
I think a boy should.
Yes, we don't apply that rule to boys, right? Like with boys, it's fine to have a fairly significant removal of tissue. At an age when a boy clearly cannot consent.
Yeah, but the question that this colleague posed during the World Association of Sexual Health Conference, he gave an illustration. There's a female where you cannot touch the genitals with a knife, a boy where you fair game, and then the intersex in the middle. So where does an enlarged clitoris, which is illegal to cut, become a small penis, which presumably is legal? Where is the dividing line?
Okay, well, that's, yeah, let's talk about intersex, because that's, I don't know if you know Alice Drager, but I interviewed her. She's done a lot of work in the United States with intersex, and it's been kind of controversial, because there are some people who are very, maybe I would call it extreme in their views about intersex, who believe that it's important to change to the sex that you are, but she's pointing out that in some cases it's the doctor who says, this is a little girl, so let's remove the boy bits. And then it turns out that this child feels like they're a boy, but now they're missing the boy bits, or vice versa, right? It seems
when you say that the sex you are intersex, you're not male or female.
Well, yes, but I mean, I don't think she'd agree with that. I think she would say that there are some who feel strongly that they're a boy or a girl. They feel internally as one or the other, but their organs don't reflect that. As well as there are people who call themselves non-binary who don't feel they fit into the category. And I'm okay with all of those things, but I think that you should make permanent decisions such as surgery when you're an adult.
Exactly.
And not as a child, because I don't even think like a 12-year-old, although they have a lot of, you know, intelligence at that age to make a decision that I want to be a different sex than I was, that my biological sex, I think that's too much to make at such a young age. But we have doctors. I mean, she described a situation where a child is born, their parts don't look normal, the parents are freaked out, and the doctor says, well, we can fix it. And so what kinds of operations are doctors doing in the UK on these intersex babies?
Well, I'm pleased to say that now they are, and certainly in our local hospital, they don't do it at all.
So it's now basically illegal or just not NHS
funded?
No, they
just don't do it. They tend to, unless it's life-threatening, you know, if there's something that's affecting function of the body, then they will.
Oh, right, obviously, but like if the penis didn't have an opening or something like that, then you've got to fix that, right?
Question. If there's something that is affecting the function of the body, that they can't function without, well, yes, they do it, but they will now not do an operation just on the. Just to change the gender, basically, or just to alter the gender. So I presume that would be cosmetic. Certainly in our local hospital, and I was there talking to them about last year that we were holding a conference at Keele University, which is my local university, and which is linked to a teaching hospital. And I'm on the lay panel. A lay member of the medical school.
Mm-hmm.
So, and certainly in that hospital there, they do not do circumcisions, and they do not do unnecessary circumcision, operations on intersex.
But is this a local issue, or is it a British government or NHS policy?
I think it's down to each particular hospital trust, but I would guess that mine is fairly typical. I mean, certainly where male circumcision is concerned, it's across the board. You know, it's not available on the NHS unless it's for a medical issue.
Right. So
but
you'd have
with
to
intersex
find.
Surgery, I'm not too sure. We would need to do a bit of an investigation on that. And that's probably something that's on our to-do list.
Yeah. Is intersex genital autonomy kind of a new thing for you?
Genital autonomy was formed in 2008, and it was I was at a conference at Keele University, and I met the then children's ombudsman or commissioner for Tasmania, and he said that there was a need to include all children. So genital autonomy works at a different level. It does like 15 Square works to help people. Genital autonomy works on policy, so we're working with policymakers and lawmakers. So we don't actually deal with the public with the issue. We're at a much higher level.
Right. I mean, it seems to me that you've identified a kind of a bit of a conundrum. Like we can all, I think now most people would agree that it's right to ban all female genital mutilation, and it doesn't matter how much you say this is part of my culture. We're going to say it's wrong until the girl's of age, and if she wants to manipulate her genitals at that point through a piercing or through some religious procedure, that's her choice. But if we don't say that with boys, we say, well, it's fine, we're not going to pay for it, but it's fine to do it if you're religious or if you are convinced that there's a medical benefit.
There's two things there. A, we don't say it's fine to do it for, you know, it should be, what we're saying is it should be down to that, it should be down to the owner of the penis.
No, I'm not talking about you.
I'm
talking about the British government. The British government is saying female genital mutilation is illegal.
Yes.
And we can all agree with that. Even if it's more of a symbolic manipulation, a symbolic change, it should be illegal.
Yes.
But they're saying we're not going to encourage male circumcision, but if for religious reasons or for, you know, you think there's health reasons, go ahead and get it done. We're not going to pay for it, but you can go.
I don't think they're even saying that. I think it's just default.
Right. But they're not saying it's illegal.
No, they're not saying it's illegal. They're not saying it's legal. It's just there's a blind eye turned to it. It's always gone on.
Right.
Don't challenge it, basically.
Okay, so
but it is being challenged. As I've said, these court cases will gradually bring about change.
Right, but also intersex, because with intersex, do you say it's invalid to make any changes following the lead of banning female genital mutilation, or do we say, well, whatever you and the doctor decide to do with your child is fine, because it's just like circumcision? You know, where do intersex children fit in? Do they get protected like females?
I don't think there's any law against it. I think that it's probably dealt with on the individual case.
Mm.
And I would, like I said before, I think it's probably dealt with by a hospital trust. So if wherever you happen to be born, the attitude of that hospital trust will prevail. So, I mean, there might be a hospital trust in one area that does more than the other. I don't think that there's any set rule or guideline laid down.
My previous guest, Alistair Eger, talked about a woman in a hospital, I think, in New York City, who was very fascinated by surgeries on intersex. And
yes.
Did a lot of it and wasn't really telling the whole truth about what was happening to the parents, and certainly the child. Right.
Yeah.
Which doesn't seem like a really good situation, right?
No. I mean, what we would like to see is, we would like to see the law upheld, really. And the example is FGM in the UK. As I said, there's never been a successful prosecution, even though there's a law against it.
Oh, really?
In France, there's no specific law against it in France, but they brought over 100 successful prosecutions. They just use their normal child protection laws.
And yet they can't do that, I presume, in France. Circumcisions are tolerated.
They're tolerated in France. Male circumcisions are tolerated.
Male-term circumcisions, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there are countries where there are a lot of people are working against it. The Royal Dutch Medical Association have put a statement recommending, saying that it shouldn't be performed. The Danes and the Norwegians and the Finns certainly would like to see a ban. They're certainly moves on, they're uneasy about it, basically.
Right. I mean, it seems like it'd be very simple to say the child can have genital surgery when they're old enough to approve it. But if you did that, you would have to go up against the religious forces of Jewish and Muslim religions and maybe any other small religion that has the same things. it was kind of ironic that this could get Jews and Muslims on the same side. But I think there would be a big fight, and probably a lot of Jews and Muslims would align with their religion just because they would see it as an infringement on their religious freedom.
Yes.
So yeah. I can imagine that the bureaucrats are saying, we'll do everything we can to discourage this, but we're not going to stick our feet in the fire and try to ban it.
I mean, there just needs to be more research on it. I think there's not sufficient research done on the function of the foreskin. I think if more research was done, it's just been accepted until fairly recent times that it's a disposable part, it serves no purpose. We now know since the late 1990s that it does serve a purpose. It's a very important part of the penis. As one of my American colleagues says, it's not the candy wrapper, it's actually the candy. So the more research that's done and the more people are educated, and I think that it will gradually fall out of fashion, people won't do it. I mean, things change, you know. You don't stone adulterers to death. I can't really comment on the religious aspect because I don't belong to any of these religious groups. I mean, all I can say is once people are aware of damage, then people question it. But if people are doing something they don't think is harmful, you know, there's reason for them to question.
Right. I guess I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of a slightly cowardly bureaucrat who's kind of has an awareness that male circumcision shouldn't really be going on and is hoping that it gradually fades away so they don't have to come out and tackle it face on, because they know that they're going to unleash a huge amount. And I mean, if the UK say we're banning male circumcision outright, there would be money flooding in from Jewish and Muslim groups all around the world to defend their rights to do genital mutilation of their children. So who wants to be the first bureaucrat to offer themselves up to the fire of criticism that they would get?
There's also going to be the reverse of this, is when people start suing their circumcisers when they're old enough.
Yes, yes.
That's another way, because, I mean, we certainly have on our books, we have people from Jewish and Muslim families who would love to sue their circumcisers. They're deeply upset about it.
And why is it not possible to do that?
They need to find out who did it.
And this might be 15, 20 years later, right?
Well, yes. I mean, you're looking at somebody who reaches adulthood, so it's 18 years of age. They have a limited time, 18 to 24. And first of all, they've got to get their notes of who did it. And then they've got to find somebody to take on the case.
Right.
This is where it falls down. And what we would like to see is a mandatory recording, because if you have any other procedure carried out in a hospital, then or by a doctor, then it should be recorded. But there seems to be very little recording of circumcisions, and if they are recorded, then they are not... So, for instance, if you went and got your records and it said you'd had a circumcision for phimosis, even though you didn't have phimosis, you wouldn't have a leg to stand on.
Who wouldn't have a leg to stand on? Like the doctor or the...
You would, if you were trying to build to sue, you wouldn't have the... You've got to have the evidence.
Nobody can prove this 20 years later that you didn't have phimosis. Therefore, if the doctor writes down phimosis, circumcision, then the doctor's fine. But if the doctor says, you know, it was a religious circumcision and things go wrong, then the doctor might be liable.
Or even if things go right, if it's a non-therapeutic operation, technically you could sue for it.
Right.
And I can see the other way around. I can see that eventually, and what we've been, we had a meeting with the General Medical Council And what we said to them is that we were pressing for a register to be completed, so that any circumcisions carried out in the UK, that it should be recorded who did it, when it was done, where it was done, who it was done by, and what was the reason.
And I think, yeah, that would probably be the start, the beginning of the end, because a lot of doctors just wouldn't want the hassle. They would know that they were exposed in case of any kind of problems that occurred immediately, or if a child realizes when they reach puberty that they don't have the sexual sensation they should have. We're reaching the end of our time, I'd just like to ask you if there's any things that you'd like to get out that you haven't had time to do so far before we wrap up.
I think we've covered quite. I think we've covered quite a lot. But I think to sum up, really, I would say that what we're trying to do is first of all promote alternatives where somebody has a problem with their foreskin. They should be treated conservatively, and then there would be very little medical circumcision. It would be almost never done. And as I was saying with regard to the, it's giving people a choice, basically. So like you were saying about the religious issue, it's if a person wasn't able to give consent, they should be able to give consent, and if they're not able to give consent, they should have redress at a later stage, should they want to.
I mean, religions can change. I mean, is it the Baptist religion that went for adult baptism on the basis that you shouldn't be baptized until you're old enough to know what you're doing? And this seems, I mean, baptism is purely a religious thing. Then if you don't drown in the water, then there's no harm done. You just get a little wet. But here, there's harm done, and yet children don't have the autonomy. So,
a very close Jewish friend of mine, she always says, and she's a great campaigner against this practice, and one of the first I knew to leave her son intact. And she said, religions change, they evolve, and this is one that she's working to change. You know, you are Jewish if you're born to a Jewish mother. No, and another Jewish friend always says your religion should be in your heart, not your penis.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's a good way to end it. Thank you, David, for joining me today.
And my pleasure.
I had a very good conversation.
Have a good
with
day.
You. Yes, you too. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to episode 148 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount.